You're listening to Playtime's Playcast, the arts with a bit of activism, with me, your host, author, artist, and playwright, W.C. Turk. On today's episode, we hear from Peter Jolie about his latest album, Easy Has Never Been the Way. Peter's own life story has a bit of a mythological feel to it. Peter takes us on the faithful journey from Buffalo, New York to Chicago. That's all coming up on this episode of Playtime's Playcast.
What I really want is inspiration and words to make you cry. Just a little hint of determination in a song that can get you by. Just a simple tune to raise your spirits every single time that you feel like dying. A tiny little flash of pure elation.
American folk music owes its origins to Appalachian mountain music, which likewise grew from Scottish and Irish and French folk music, cooked in bluegrass, deepened by slave spirituals, and sustained and enriched by the blues. Musicologist John Lomax in the early part of the 20th century recognized the Black voice as the anchor of American folk music, most especially through the music of a recently released convict. At a hotel in Marshall, Texas in 1934, Lomax met with that convict, Huddy William Leadbetter, whom the world would come to know as Leadbelly. Leadbelly had already been performing for 30 years before Lomax's discovery. Folk music's theme bubble and percolate from a working class culture. If we take music as the fullest experience of community and culture, a unique form of sublime expression, which activates the entire brain of the musician and synchronizes the brains of its listeners, then folk stands as a critical pillar in our once and future evolution. The roots of American folk music certainly evolved in a continuum since mankind began cultivating the rhythms of nature into something specifically human more than 100,000 years ago. For this discussion, we need only to look back across 150 years or so. American folk music, this once and future genre, is hardly a fossil, but is instead very much alive and well here at the start of the 21st century through the works of Joan Baez, Woody Guthrie, Joni Mitchell, Bob Dylan, Annie DeFranco, Pete Seeger, Tom Rush, John Prine, Bright Eyes, and Phil Ochs, just to name a few. Add to that list a Buffalo native turned Chicagoan, Peter Jolie, with one L, with the melancholic whimsy of John Prine, the imagery of Richard Schindel, and a bit of Randy Newman's soul. Jolie's is a space to watch. Jolie's brand of American-style folk music is in great thoughts rendered gently. Thoughts like, achieving with each other is the closest thing to God we're ever going to find. Peter's latest collection of richly personal songs is titled Easy Has Never Been the Way, which is available at Bandcamp, as is his powerful and beautiful 2016 self-titled debut album. A link to both albums is up in the notes below. Welcome to the Playtime Playcast, buddy. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you, Bill. That was educational and
Did I miss anything? I think I covered 100,000 years of human history.
Yeah, you sure did. And you covered the Carter family, which who were influences of mine for sure.
Nice. Very, very nice. By the way, we have some friends in common. Naomi Ashley, Dag Julin, who's been on the show, Curtis Ruptash, Nan Warshaw, Rachel Drew, who I know you know, who sings backup harmonies on your albums.
She sure does. And also in live performances as well.
Yeah.
Rachel and I met each other, must be 10 years ago now. And she's been singing with me steadily for the last seven on both on the recording projects and also on the live shows. So, and I feel blessed to have her as part of my band and part of my recording personnel as well. She's just outstanding.
Yeah, she is. She's got an unbelievable voice. You guys sound absolutely magical together.
Yeah, well, that's for her. That's she's excellent at what they call kind of close harmonies.
Uh-huh.
She really she works hard to make it sound effortless. And
it's a rare marriage between a lead and a backup singer to have those harmonies come together so perfectly. I've been privileged to speak with a number of artists who have gone through backup singer after backup singer to try to find that right one. And it's nothing short of fateful.
Yeah, you're looking for that chemistry. And when we started singing together, it seemed natural, and it wasn't difficult to kind of get that chemistry.
Yeah, yeah. Why folk music?
Well, you know, I've always just been drawn to, from a very young age, to the acoustic guitar and to the singer-songwriter genre and expression of music.
Remember that first artist that you heard that did it for you?
Yeah, there were a number of artists. Joan Armatrading,
okay,
James Taylor, of course, Bob Dylan. It was just when I heard Bob Dylan, it immediately registered with me as something that was so full of expression, yet so minimalistic. Bringing those qualities together and this explosion of beautiful art in very simple songs and lyrics as well.
Yeah. You're originally from Buffalo, New York.
Yes.
Or is Williamsville actually the place where you grew up?
Yeah. So I grew up in Williamsville, New York, which is 10 minutes outside of the city line. Buffalo, New York. Williamsville was this idyllic village that was founded in the mid 1800s. I just spent my days in creekside and wooded areas. I started playing guitar at a very young age. I was drawn to music. I knew it was what I was going to be doing for my entire life. I knew that I was going to be dedicating myself, feast or famine to music. It was just something that was in my heart and in my blood.
Williamsville, it all began in Williamsville, when only time would tell which promises I'd keep. When to break away into discovery that there must be something more for me across the muddy creek of Williamsville. It all comes back to Williamsville, or so I found that at least it does for me. The old water mill, sawdust over every floor, was pulverizing apple cars, spinning out the sea.
So why Chicago? Why not New York? Or
that's a great question. Buffalo, New York. A lot of people associate Buffalo, New York. They say, "Oh, you're from Buffalo," and they make the connection to New York City, as you said. In fact, Buffalo is almost equidistant from Chicago as it is from New York City. It's about 600 miles, give or take, in either direction.
And it has that working class profile, which is perfect for folk.
Sure. And I left Buffalo in my mid 20s, having played there since I was had to show fake ID to get into the places I was performing at. Started playing out at about 16, 17 years old, and while I was still in high school. And I was looking for a more robust music scene at the time.
Okay.
So I did have people in both New York City and, as it happened, I had people here in Chicago. My Chicago people, were looking for a new living situation. So they were looking for someone to, share expenses with and share housing with. And so, that was the reason that I decided to come west instead of going east, a little bit. That's what landed me here in Chicago in 1993.
And I think in Chicago, at least for a working artist, we're so much more livable and affordable than New York.
Absolutely. And the music community here, immediately upon exiting the train, I took the city of New Orleans train line to Chicago from Buffalo, New York. And within the first week or so, I was exploring the haunts of the Earl of Old Town's place called Sylvester's over on Damon
Avenue.
And just looking for stages and trying to meet musicians, and they were so welcoming and engaging and accepting of what I was trying to do, so it was an excellent experience. My welcome to Chicago.
You were asked to take part in a John Prine tribute in May of 2020 at the Acorn Theater. I believe. And that's a hell of an honor. Talk about that a little bit. And about John Prine, who is an Illinois native and who passed away tragically in 2020. But
well, amazingly, I had not been exposed to John Prine before moving to the Midwest, moving to Chicago.
Yeah.
So when I discovered John Prine, it was, as you can imagine, it was exhilarating. It was exciting. I just couldn't stop looking for more of his music and listening to what he had done and what he was doing.
Mm-hmm.
That Acorn gig, I had forgotten about that gig. Yeah, that was Sarah Thompson was the director. She just recently moved on from the Acorn, but we had known each other through mutual musicians. She was interested in what I was doing, and she thought I would be a good fit for that Prime project. And so that's how I got involved with the Acorn. What a venue, what a beautiful venue. I'd also done some other stuff with the Acorn. They had a songwriter show/showcase that I'd done a couple of. And that room is it's a special room. You've been there, I assume?
To the yes. Acorn. Oh yeah, yeah.
Beautiful space. And so I was really proud to have been asked to do that. And I love John Prine, so.
Your writing style, your lyric style has some really strong elements of that whimsy and that melancholic whimsy, but that the sort of push and pull between light and dark thoughts and themes that the John Prine shared.
Brilliant at that. He was just so brilliant at taking an emotion or a subject that's not necessarily something that you would want to think that would inspire somebody, but as you said, he would put a turn on it that shows you a different side of it, almost like you're walking around the side of something and looking behind it, and it shows you things that you didn't know were there. I call it silver lining songwriting.
Oh, okay, I love that.
There's a range of emotions, human experience that we all share. When you think about it, it's limited. And so in every experience we have, whether it's a joyous experience or a very, very painful experience that causes us grief or other emotions, everyone experiences those. And so it's just the way that he was able to, as you said, kind of take a slant on it and make us all realize that, we're all going through this together. And maybe it's not as bad as it could be, because we have each other to kind of laugh about it. And
as you're speaking here, I'm sitting here trying to think of any other genre of music. Next week, I'm talking with Steve Tormé, Mel Tormé's son.
Oh wow!
Who's just put out a great swing album, kind of in the fashion of his father.
I went through a Mel Tormé phase.
I think we all have. I'm sort of circling back to it as I'm getting ready for this interview. I think swing has the ability to do that. Maybe the blues a little bit, but not as much as American folk music, where that's really a unique aspect, that broader, richer, greater spectrum of storytelling within a song.
Oh, absolutely. You mentioned the Western swing and swing in general sound, and it's in with acoustic music and country music and blues and that.
Yeah.
Another huge influence for me was Lyle Lovett. When I discovered Lyle Lovett, my songwriting methodology really grew just from listening to Joshua Judge's Ruth record. I was obsessed with that album.
Right. Yeah.
And I discovered Lyle. Love it.
Mm-hmm.
I was driving a cab in Buffalo, New York. It was the last my last employment before I got on a train and came to Chicago. I was driving a cab and I was working the 4 p.m. to 4 a.m. shift. And I heard this songwriter who was relatively new at the time and really was only being played on college radio, indie radio stations.
Right, right.
I heard him interviewed and I just heard his music and I heard all of those things that I love about music, which is the easiness of his delivery, the tongue-in-cheek of his lyric, brilliant lyrics that he has, and his delivery, his singing just blew me away. And so I really kind of emulated him and started to use things that I heard in his music and trying to kind of incorporate that into my songwriting. So
your songwriting comes across very fresh and very unique. I get that you're looking at themes and mechanics and parts and pieces that are inspirational to you. That's really parcel of music. I think it was it Mick Jagger that said, if we didn't steal from each other, there wouldn't be any music.
Absolutely.
But you do it seamlessly and your music is very fresh. I want to start with talking about the music. I want to start with your debut album, the song God in Love in June, which starts, "I'm an old skunk and a bad drunk. I never hid anything up my sleeve. And I believe in God, in love, and in June."
I'm an old skunk. I was a bad drunk. Never hid nothing up my sleeve, and I believe in God and in love and in June. I should have died 20 years ago. Instead, I am the first one to know. She's gone, and how deep a heartbreak can make a man take his sorrow. I'm an old skunk. I was a bad.
I hear that song was completed shortly after the passing of the great June Carter.
That's correct. Yeah, you know, I wrote that song, or actually that song wrote itself the day or the day after I'd heard the news that June Carter had died. And I had been a huge Johnny Cash fan ever since the first time I'd heard his mm-hmm. record. Orange Blossom Special was, I think, the first Johnny Cash record that I ever kind of devoured when I was about 11 years old.
Yeah.
It over and over again. And that movie had just come out, Walk the Line. And I was very impacted by seeing that movie mm-hmm. As a fan of his life and his music. That really depicted well their relationship and how they came together and just the perfect relationship that they finally did have. And so when she'd passed away, I just had thought, it just hit me that he must be at that moment, probably about the saddest guy on the planet right then and there.
Yeah.
And so that song just kind of wrote itself just trying to depict almost in his voice. It's mm-hmm. When you listen to it, I intentionally dropped it to a very, very low register, about as low as I can sing. It's kind of a tip of the hat to his beautiful baritone.
Did you send it to him?
He died. If you recall, he died just a couple of months after she did.
Yep.
And
so yep.
It hadn't been recorded by the time he had passed away. I have sent it to June Carter and to Roseanne Cash's people, and I haven't gotten anything back. Who knows if they received it? I'm sure they get all kinds of solicitations and things about Johnny Cash, but I would hope that at some point I could get her to listen to it. But
that'd be wonderful. It's a beautiful, beautiful tribute. There's a song on the new album, Easy Has Never Been the Way, called Williamsville, which we talked about a little bit a few moments ago. It has a wonderful sense of place rendered in these familiar tones with a hint of melancholy, a bit of sarcasm, and no small amount of hometown pride. The way you render this song, it really becomes Every Town USA.
Yes, thank you. That was really well. I'm from I used very familiar places in the village of Williamsville, and not real, you know, complex analysis is, but really more of just, like, as you said, kind of a watercolor brushstrokes of the watermill of of getting fresh apple cider every summer, bringing your jug back, your used jug, cleaned out, and they fill it again, and an Ellicott Creek that runs through that town. So I was really trying to, as you said, create a snapshot. I write these songs to kind of sort out my own thoughts more than anything, and to express artistically what I feel is I must do. And so I was really happy with the way that came out. I thought it was nice and simple, innocent, but yet still expresses inside minutes or a little more the wanderlust that I was feeling at the time, needing to expand my horizons, and but also you know, never losing sight of where I came from and what I don't want to lose, and the values that I you know, use to this day to interact with the world.
You know, that brings up an interesting observation I saw in a Facebook post, where you had to bow out of a gig because of back pain. Do you suffer from chronic back pain?
Not as much as I used to.
I have
back pain through a regimen of stretches and exercises that I've learned.
The reason I brought that up is this morning on the way to take my wife to work, I was listening to the album, and I hadn't paid as much attention to the song Little Stars as I should have, but my wife suffers from chronic back pain, and she is forever fighting the negativity that comes with that sort of chronic pain issue, against trying to remain positive as a method of healing.
Yeah.
Physically and emotionally, psychologically, spiritually even.
Yeah.
The rain's rolling down your windshield, not yet enough to use the blades. What a year it's been to have to start again. Try to prove you're not afraid. It took a piece of what's inside you, stole a sliver of your soul. It took all you thought you had, and even more than that, to guide you past the devil at your door. We're little stars just trying to make it, to survive another day, another night.
So I wanted to ask you how that haunts or informs your songwriting.
Well, you know, that Little Stars song, I love that song, it was inspired by the strength, not in myself, but through someone else. I don't think my wife would mind, as I've referenced it before, but she was at that time going through treatments for cancer,
right?
And so I was with her through that, and I was witness to her tremendous strength, mm-hmm. And endurance through all of that. And I just really proud to be with her through that and to be able to support her through that. And that's where that song came from, were those feelings that of come on, you can do this. We can do this. We're going to make this. We're going to make it through this. Yeah. So not so much as a truly personal pain for me, but witnessing that. Yeah.
When did you first pick up the guitar?
I was in eighth grade, so I would say, how old are you in eighth grade? 12 years old. I would fake being sick to stay home from school a lot as much as I could. I wasn't a real diligent pupil, but so on those afternoons, my mother would be working around the house and I would be at home. Well, there was this guy on TV who'd walk around hay bales and sing to the kids and things, but it was real music. He was singing these songs. So I said, well, I think I would like to play guitar just in passing. And within 2 weeks, doorbell rings and this big older guy, he must have been in his 60s at the time. His name is Bill Abrams, called him Mr. Abrams, big cowboy boots, cowboy hat and a denim jacket with sheepskin lining, comes in the house. My mother had gone out and discovered this instructor, this teacher who came and gave me lessons starting at about 12 years old through my senior year in high school. And he was just such a soul, such a great guy. He exposed me to, he was an excellent player. First of all, I believe he taught music theory at the University of Buffalo department. But he was also a member of our parish in the village, and that's where my mother found him. And so he and I were student and teacher for 5 or 6 years. Wow. To the point where
Mom.
Yeah, then I had he taught me old jazz chords. He would teach me all the old jazz standards. But then he would come in with a tune by Rush and say, hey, let's play this song by Rush. So the diversity of what he was exposing me to was so great. And to this day, it remains part of my foundation and how I hear music and how I write music.
Oh, that's brilliant. That's absolutely brilliant. And I brought that up because I was listening to, there's the title track to the album. There's this great upwelling, like a bright sunlight epiphany that seems to argue with a deeply melancholic lyric.
Living and achieving with each other. It's the closest thing to God that we're ever gonna find.
The guitar notes are so economical throughout that piece that it's breathtaking.
You mentioned the guitar. I do like to break everything down to in the final product to only what needs to be there.
Yeah,
And my producer John Williams knows that that's what I'm looking for, and so he's adopted that as his vision as well when he's working with me. And I couldn't have a better person helping me achieve what I'm trying to get at than John. But the guitar, I actually purchased a 1957 Gibson J45 guitar, just for this recording project. I was in New York in Greenwich Village, and there was a guitar store there. It's not there anymore. He's closed. Ustinov, I believe, was the name of the guy who ran the place. Mm-hmm. I went in there and I saw this J45 hanging behind the counter, and I played on it, and it was a 1957. And at the time I was there, I didn't have the finances or the wherewithal to get it back to Chicago. But I came back to Chicago and I said, I need to have a 1957 J45 to record this record with, because I just loved the sound of it. It's got a kind of a chunkier neck on it. That year's model is known for the comfort of having that nice big neck in your hand and really being able to dig in and play that music. And it's got this baritone sound to it, but yet this clarity in the higher notes, but it has a lot of authority and a lot of maturity to the sound, especially. I do attribute that to it being, you know, decades and decades old. And so I was able to come back to Chicago. I found a J45, and that's the guitar I use for this record. And boy, oh boy, it's my most prized possession. I love that guitar. It speaks to me. Playing it is a pleasure every time I take it out of the case. It's magic.
I'm going to have to re-listen to it, bearing that in mind, and hearing for that specific sound. But a producer can make or break an artist and a record.
Yeah. John and I have been working together. John Williams is he's a real journeyman here in on the Chicago music scene. He's a producer. He is an amazing musician. Mm-hmm. He's a multi-instrumentalist. He plays in multiple bands. Old-timey music is really what his passion is. But he plays in a jazz organ combo. Just he's all over the place. But he and I, when I came to Chicago, I formed my first band with John as the lead guitar player. Mm-hmm. And that was a band called Big Breakfast. And I came here in 93, and we probably put that album out in 98 or something like that. It was my first recording project here. We did two records with that band. The second one was put out by Catamount Records in Nashville, a label down there. The first, it was very exciting to have some label interest, some real label interest, and some
indeed
backing, some financial backing. But he and I have known each other and worked together in that capacity. And then we kind of went our own ways, did our separate things. And then when I decided in 2016, I wanted to record that solo record, John was the first person I called to talk to him about it. And he said he thought it was a great idea, and he thought I should put it out under my own name. We'd been I'd been playing in bands that I formed, but I was doing all the writing. I was the primary writer. Mm-hmm. And so that was a great experience. But it was time to get it out there as Peter Jolie instead of under kind of umbrella band name. So he said, I'm in as much as you want me in. And I think in that first record, he really honed his chops as far as being a producer. And then so when I was doing this second one, he was right on board again. And, you know, I just let him just go with it. John made all the personnel suggestions. Mm-hmm. And they were all spot on. I don't think we had a bad experience with any of the personnel musicians that we used.
How do you come to the process of writing music? Do you write lyrics first? Is it the music? Does it depend upon, sometimes you hear a melody and that becomes the catalyst? Yeah. How do you approach the writing process?
More and more, it's the music first. I used to, it used to be a more simultaneous music and lyrics together.
Yeah.
I would kind of pick out the melody exactly as I was writing along.
And then
come up with some lyrics that work. And someone asked me once, where does it start? You know, how much of it is making it up and how much of it is writing it? The making it up part is kind of putting yourself in a place where just make your mind is a canvas, and it's an empty canvas. But as soon as you get a couple of bars that are working, then you're writing it. Now it's more of a, I'll sit with the guitar and I'll just jam for hours. Mm-hmm. And come up with some licks, some melodies, and then, you know, decide where I want to take them. So then the lyrics would come after that.
And an organic style.
Yeah. And I don't know if you've seen the movie Get Back yet.
I have not yet. No, I'm dying to though. But
it's such an example of that I could relate to of writing. Those guys were just mind blowing. And by the way, yeah, they're huge influence. That helped. That first time I heard the record helped.
No spoiler alerts. I haven't seen it, so I don't know if the band breaks up or not.
But it really shows how they just use stream of consciousness and almost childlike babbling to get the lyrics going of the songs that are now in the American songbook, and they will forever be, you know, known as the, you know, I call it classical music because I think it's going to be around forever and ever, and it's certainly not going to be considered classical music.
Yeah, a lot of that music sounds just as fresh as the day it was created. I'm going to say the same about your music as well. There's a staying power that I think people will be listening to your music forever.
Wow. Well, I hope so.
Yeah. I won't say that the new album is better than the first. I think they're both really, really strong collections. But you seem older on this album.
There's never been a time I ever have been fine, even though I say when you ask, I'm dead, running out of time. So it's always on my mind, even though I don't know if sweeties can be. Try to close my eyes, but I can't sleep. Try to shed a tear, but I can't weep. Trying to find the faith it takes to keep it all together. Maybe it's a lie. All we gotta do is try. The way it's looking now, it will never get better.
Well, this there was a lot that happened between the first record and the second record.
Yeah,
and you know, as the songwriting chops are always evolving. Yeah, there was a more of a heaviness to this album, you know, aptly titled Easy Has Never Been the Way. When I looked at this collection of songs, and that was the one that really seemed, that track was the one that really seemed to kind of cradle all of the other songs and make it a cohesive.
I want to say that there's more layers and undertones to this newest album. I'm thinking of a real song. Describe that song a little bit. First of all, I love this line. We all know how it feels to cry.
Everyone feels a broken heart. Everyone feels a broken heart. Everyone feels a broken heart. We all know how it feels to cry.
Which is just a brilliant way of cutting through the superfluous to that thing that we all share in common, pain.
Oh, that's wonderful. And it's spot on that is what you take away from it, because that song was inspired by a six-year-old girl, or maybe a five or six-year-old girl. I had been experiencing some writer's block. I hadn't written anything that I thought was worthwhile for months. And for me, that was scary. You know, I was kind of nervous about that. And so I had the occasion to have an all day kind of a nanny session with my 5-year-old niece at the time. Her name is Hazel. And so I brought my guitar. I knew I was going to be there over there for 12 hours or so. So I thought I'd kind of write some music while I was there and see what the day brought. And so I got over there and I was telling her about my problems with the writer's block, and she was telling me about how she had just learned that she was coloring at a grade above her current grade. And all so right. we tried to write a couple songs about coloring at a grade. You know, I just got childlike with her, and we wrote a song about coloring at a grade above where you were at now. We wrote a song about some kind of dancing fairy, I believe.
Wow.
And so I said to her, I said, Hazel, do you think I'll ever get over this writer's block? And she said, she gave me the title of the song. She said, Uncle Pete, why don't you just write a real song? Because she knew that I was messing around. You know, she knew that I was not being serious. And she's a bright kid, and she knew that I wasn't really writing anything that I was interested in. So,
so I missed her in the writing credits. Is she?
she didn't get the writing credit. But anyways, that's where I went home and I wrote a real song. And I just thought about what she said, and it's really so true. From the mouths of babes, when you think about it, just go home. Why don't you just write a real song? Meaning, you know, listen to your heart, listen to yourself, and don't be afraid to you know, get real again. I can tell you're not being serious with these songs. So get back into it. And so it's so inspiring. I just wrote that song.
Brilliant. Umbrellas and Overcoats. We're kind of moving through the album here. You rendered that as a waltz or a colonial style schottische.
Mm-hmm.
But then you kind of throw this left hook at us with this quiet and understated percussion line. The tambourine offers this bright and pretty accent to the song and sort of lifts it out of that colonial style waltz into this beautiful modern piece.
Thanks. Yeah, that's Alex Hall. He's the proprietor of Reliable Recorders here in Chicago. Mm-hmm. He's also the percussionist for the Flat Five, if you're familiar with the Flat Five out of Chicago.
Yeah.
And he plays with Joel Patterson. So he's mm-hmm. toured the world playing music. He's just a brilliant player. So I was fortunate to been using his studio for a lot of the recording sessions, the basic track sessions for the record. And John asked him if he'd be willing to play drums on whatever he felt he could contribute to. And he was very generous in doing so. And so that's Alex coming up with those parts. I love that tune. That's one of my favorite tunes on the record. It's, in a nutshell, it's Urban Cowboy looking for love.
You with your old-fashioned ways and your old-fashioned songs that your radio plays. Just one day a week if your reception is strong and the weather is clear.
La-di-da. You write, there's 100,000 sorrows trying to dominate my soul. As a folk singer, I would think that it's necessary to cut out those myriad chaotic sounds and noises and stories and the craziness, the cross currents that we find ourselves here at this time in history faced with. How do you edit out that noise so that you can get to a place as an artist to write lines like that?
You know, it's so interesting, and you've heard it so many times that the creative process is such a mystery. And when a line like that comes, it really informs, okay, here we go. This is that's the first line of the song. There's 100,000 sorrows trying to dominate my soul. And so it's, I don't know. It's magical. Something like that comes to you, and it's so simplistic and simple, not simplistic, I guess, but it's simple. and beautiful and says so much to be that as we again get back to that, we all have you know, these familiar emotions that we're all experiencing.
Mm-hmm.
There's limited ways to express them. We all do it differently, but yeah.
La-dee-da, la-dee-do, la-dee-da, la-dee-do, la-dee-da, la-dee-do. There's 100,000 sorrows trying to dominate my soul. Through the windows of a tavern, a sober man would never know. They say I brought it all upon me.
I saved this song for last. Honey Babe seems to be garnering the most attention off the album, and for really good reason. It's a great song. There's a blues base to that song that makes it stand out from the other songs on the album.
Yeah, I love that song. We've all been there, right? We've all had relationships that didn't work out.
Uh-huh.
That we felt we were not responsible for them not working out. We've all had been there, where been there, done that, right? So I knew it would be relatable for people. It's also, as you said, employing my it's going to be fine, but this really sucks. And also I'm really pissed too, but so it has all of those things going on in it.
There's a little bit of vengefulness in that song.
It's really and that song is an aggregate of those type of breakup songs, but specifically it was inspired by a situation that I was observing, not part of at the time, but it was something that I just I really took sides on. The people I was watching. And so it was clear to me that one person was right and one person was wrong, and one person was getting really screwed over. So that's where that came from. And so it was kind of a, here, I'm going to back you up on this. Here's a song about what you're going through. It was tracked. I love that tune because it was tracked live. Me on the J45, the Gibson guitar that I was talking about. John Williams playing his grandfather's acoustic guitar on that. It's a 100-year-old parlor guitar that just has
wow,
beautiful sound on it. And then Josh Pyatt on upright bass. We tracked that at John's home recording studio in Berwyn, or actually just on the Chicago City line, but almost in Berwyn. And we all just played it live. So that was the three of us playing it live. From there, we took it and we added more stuff. But that energy, the vocal is completely live, playing to those with those three instruments. I think we maybe took two or three runs at it and said, okay, that's the one right there. And from there, we, you know, we polished it up and did a couple of overdubs with other musicians and things, but kept it as that bare bones sound is what we really wanted to achieve with that.
You nailed it. Tom Rush joined us on the show a while back. I'll ask you what I asked him. Would the world be a better place if we paid more attention to folk singers?
Oh, of course. Absolutely. The world would be a better place if everyone paid more attention to folk singers. I think folk singers have have a lot to say, and they have a lot of love.
I love that. I love that. What do you got going on in the future? Live performances are still kind of shaky, but...
Next Saturday, if it goes off, I'm really looking forward to our next full band show. It's going to be at Fitzgerald's out in Berwyn in the Saturday night, the 22nd. We're going to have the night. We do two sets. And so we're going to be playing all the songs off of probably both these records that you mentioned and some others as well. I'll have Josh Pyatt with me, John Williams, Rachel Drew will be there, and Isaac David Lyons on keyboards.
Wow.
And so it's the new space, the new sidebar space at Fitzgerald's. They knocked down walls and they took the occasion during the, you know, the closure during the, all of what's been going on in the past couple of years to, improve and renovate and kind of double the space inside that performance area. And so it'll be my first time getting back to the new space there. So really looking forward to that. In February, I'll be sharing a night over at the Montrose Saloon, the first Tuesday in February.
Great place.
With another artist. I'll be opening the show. I'm continuing to write songs, and I'm really looking forward to, as you said, it's, you know, gigs are tenuous right now because you see them, if they're canceled, they're usually not canceled until 24 to 48 hours beforehand. So there's really not a lot of advance notice of cancellations, but people are doing what they need to do and getting us back to a place where we can all kind of enjoy the way it used to be again. But,
you know, we'll definitely link to the Fitzgerald show in the notes here, and then we'll post that on our Facebook page as well. And then let us know about Montrose Saloon. That's almost in my neighborhood. Love to come over and see you guys live. Peter Jolie's latest album is Easy Has Never Been the Way. Seriously, watch this space and expect much more from this great talent. PeterJolie.bandcamp.com is the link, which is up here in the notes. Peter, thank you so much.
Thank you, Bill. This was really a pleasure. I really enjoyed it.
Honey, babe, what have you been smoking? Who can save the joke, believe the joke could ever leave me broken? This ain't my first rodeo where the dust has left me choking. And I've been thrown three times far before. Honey babe, what have you been drinking? Who could save that you'd believe that you could ever leave me sinking? Well, I've sailed around the world a time or two, and I've done some thinking, and I've never failed to make it back to shore. Honey babe, what have you been doing? You've been playing.